Okay, so for those of you who don't know me, I'm Laurette Dubé. I'm the James McGill Chair in Consumer Psychology and Marketing at the Faculty of Management. I'm also the founding chair and scientific director of the research center that will soon come to birth, as well as a major world platform. The research center is a brain to society research center, which, if you believe that we can do a better job in creating a modern environment that does not present too much challenge for human biology, then the outreach of this is basically changing the world. So we have also at the same time the Brain to Society Center is the research anchor of something that we call the McGill World Platform for Health and Economic Convergence, which has been developed with the leadership of both the Faculty of Management, but also, and most importantly, the Faculty of Medicine, with many colleagues from neuroscience, from genetics, from public health, and so on, being involved with the idea that we could do better, whether it's from a behavioral perspective, from policy, from business innovation, from finance for that matter, if we mainstream a bit of what we know so much more now about human biology into what we do on the economic side, and conversely on the health and healthcare, as now healthcare cost is bankrupting everybody in every country, if we were to weave a bit more of economics and finance into what we do on the mainstream health and healthcare as well. So this is kind of the big picture of the Brain to Society and the McGill World Platform for those of you who did not know or had not heard, because I realized that our brand is making its way around the world, but too often we neglect to talk about it here at McGill, so I always take the occasion. And second, also as part of building this novel capacity, with my colleague Antoine Béjara, who has been recruited on the CRC chair last year to be the scientific leader from the neuroscience perspective of this Brain to Society agenda. Antoine and I will start teaching next week a course in decision neuroscience to bring to bear this most recent knowledge of biology, and including gene, brain, and hormones, as we'll be talking tonight, into concretely how we're using this in terms of promoting innovation and finance. And for the last many years, we have been talking a lot about obesity, about this kind of addiction-like response we have to all the food that we have around us. But it is also the case that knowing more of how the human machine operates can help in domains of finance as serious, quote-unquote, as trading and stock markets. So it is with very great pleasure that we host today John Coles, who is, in my view, one of the most promising, do we call neuroscientists, physiologists? What do we call you? Who happened to have had a PhD in economics from Cambridge from his early days in the early 82, I believe.
91.
Had a very successful career on Wall Street from 10 to 12 years, and then decided that he could do even better, or help the world to do even better, if we were to do more of the basic science in understanding biology and informing what we do on the trading and financial aspects, decision making. And that is with very great pleasure that I would like you to welcome him for a talk on the biology of financial decision making. John, welcome.
When I ran this experiment, I used to feel sorry for this guy because he didn't have any hair. Now people think it's me. I'm going to tell you about a series of experiments we've been running on a trading floor in the City of London. But I'll probably start off before we get into the slides telling you how the research came about. I used to run a trading desk on Wall Street, a derivative trading desk at Deutsche Bank. And during the years of the dot-com bubble, I noticed the traders on the floor, not only on the trading floor, but all along Wall Street, and in fact in Manhattan as a whole, that people were acting quite strange. There were, the traders on the floor in particular were displaying what might be called classical clinical symptoms of mania. They were delusional, euphoric, overconfident. They had diminished need for sleep. And there was a lot more porn on their computer screens back in the days when you could have that on your screens at an office. And this was notable because it wasn't that these people were like that. It's not that Wall Street selects for these types of people. These people were not like this before the bubble, and they weren't like this after the bubble. So something during the bubble was changing them. And what it really seemed like is that they were under the influence of a chemical. And when the market, when the dot-com bubble popped, in the aftermath, they were like people with a hangover. And I was really struck by this because it really did seem like there was a chemical involved. Now, I was not affected by the dot-com bubble. I wasn't involved in any way. I was slightly skeptical of the whole thing. But having said that, I had been caught up in previous bubbles, even if they're small ones that you never hear about. And I know that when traders are making above-average profits and expecting above-average bonuses, we get a chemical high that's as powerful as anything you can feel, as powerful as any the most insistent desire or wall-banging anger that you can feel, and they're very hard to control. And unlike the other passions we may feel, there's no sort of cultural, we're not brought up with a moral code and cultural reinforcements to teach us, you know, if you're angry, we're taught you don't hit the person, you just don't do that. But unfortunately, in our culture, we're not taught that when you get like really excited, you're not supposed to go out and buy a billion long bonds because we're just not told that. In fact, quite the opposite happens if you're doing well. So I thought there was a chemical involved, and I thought it was extremely powerful. And by the way, when Michael Lewis uses the term big swinging dick or Tom Wolfe masters the universe, they really were describing the way these traders carry themselves. So I thought this was interesting. I thought there was a chemical involved. It was one that I had experienced. I thought this was really important primary data. And it occurred to me that it was odd. In all the research that had gone into understanding financial market instability, from economics, from psychology, behavioral finance, now lately neuroscience, game theory, all these fields, nobody had ever looked medically at what was happening to traders during a bubble or a crash. And it was an extraordinary. It means that effectively in these fields there was no field work. I mean, in field work, you're supposed to gather the anomalous observations and bring them back to the lab, and that's where you study them. So in a real science, you might get Robert Sapolsky with his baboons in Kenya noticing that a lot of the subordinate baboons were dying of peptic ulcers. Well, that's curious. What's going on? So he takes that fact back with them back to university, and they work on it, and they start disentangling the biology of the stress response. But no one was doing that in economics, and this to me was an anomalous observation that wasn't being taken back to the lab. There was another part of the observation. Actually, I should probably go on. And that was that women seemed relatively unaffected by the dot-com bubble. So I thought there was a chemical at work here that was sort of causing men to go bonkers, and it wasn't affecting the women. There was, now when I say that nobody was looking clinically at what was going on, there was one brave exception. There's a very impressive neuroscientist and psychiatrist named, I've forgotten his name, but anyway, he published an article during the dot-com bubble saying, why is it this bubble is taking on such, going to such extreme lengths? And he speculated that it was due to Prozac, because he thought that somehow these people didn't recognize risk anymore, and he thought it might have been Prozac that was at work. And, I mean, he got a lot of heat for that. And I heard him speak at a conference, and he said if he could take back anything, any one sentence he'd said in his life, or anything he'd said in his life, it would have been that. But I thought it was an interesting idea, that because he was trying to get at what chemical was involved. At any rate, okay, so what the train of thought was that, okay, we're not looking at the physiology of traders, and we probably should be. We should probably be taking a medical look at what's happening to traders. So why aren't we? And that led on to another thought, and that is that within these subjects, we seem to have inherited a very powerful and pervasive notion of the mind-body split, which started with Plato, was sort of enthroned by Paul in Christianity, was given further credence by Descartes with his notion of the brain being a ghost in the machine. And the idea is that we've got this spark of divinity in our brain, a rational mind caught in a decaying body. But the point is that this spark of divinity is rational and it's somehow separate from the body. And we all know this. It's very familiar to us. But it also seems to be showing up in the sciences, for God's sakes. I mean, it seems to be a really pervasive. It's not just a philosophical idea. It's really showing up in the sciences. And, I mean, in economics, it's one of the most powerful instances of this split, mind-body split. Because within economics, you do have this idea of, like, we're carrying around this supercomputer in our brain that can probability weight every event, can assess the utility of every event that is possible at a time in history and probability weighted. So I think there was this mind-body idea was actually informing a lot of these subjects. Now, there's a lot of scientists around the world who are taking issue with this and sort of, they haven't all hooked up. There's like people working on embodied cognition, for example. But there's a very interesting group in Cambridge that call themselves motor chauvinists a neuroscientist and engineer named Daniel Wolpert. And they asked the simple question, why do we have a brain? Because not all animals have a brain. And they come up with a starting point for thinking about mind and body, which I think is a lot more interesting than this mind-body split that we've inherited from Platonism and Christianity. And they make a lot of this little critter. This is what's called a sea sponge called the tunicate. Now, the tunicate is born with a primitive brain called a cerebral ganglion. And it swims around the seas looking for rich feeding grounds. When it finds these feeding grounds, it cements itself head first to the sea floor and then digests its brain. It doesn't need it anymore. And it just spends the rest of its life swaying in the currents, filtering nutrients from the water. And it no longer has any need for a brain. And they think this is a pretty clear indication that the point of the brain is motor output, which is why they call themselves motor chauvinists. That anything we do with our brain eventually is supposed to issue in motor commands. That even higher thought, that thought itself is simulation. You're planning or simulating future motions. And even higher thought are just basically hijacking these forms of planning and applying them to other subjects. And that gives you a very, very different idea of how the body and brain are connected. It means that the brain is really intimately connected with the body. And it makes sense because we probably evolved that way. Body and brain probably evolved together to cooperate together in coordinating our actions in important situations like fighting off a grizzly bear. So this is all by way of a very long preamble. Now, while I was on Wall Street and started thinking along these lines, I was coincidentally just splitting my time between the trading desk and a neuroscience lab in the Upper East Side at Rockefeller University. And Rockefeller is extremely good at studying steroid hormones in the brain. And I began to think about hormones as one of the systems in the body that connects the body and the brain and helps body and brain coordinate its activity. So now what exactly are hormones? I think when a lot of guys, at least not medics, but a lot of guys outside of the medical department, like me before I started this research, think that hormones are something that women have but men don't. But of course that isn't right. Hormones are just chemical messengers sent from one part of your body to another, carrying a message. And they're not mechanical. They act more like lobby groups. So a hormone like ghrelin carries a message from your stomach to your brain as a lobby group, and it says, please, on behalf of the stomach, we urge you to eat. But you can ignore it. If you're on a diet, or if you're fasting, if you're on a hunger strike, you can ignore that message. But that lobby group will get more and more insistent. The next time it comes back, it says, listen, you eat, or we're going to start breaking up the furniture, which is basically what it does. So these hormones exert pressure on our decisions. We can ignore them. The stronger we are, the more training we have, we can ignore them. But they become more and more insistent. And there's different classes of hormones. There are the amines, like adrenaline and noradrenaline. There's peptides like leptin and ghrelin. And there's steroid hormones. And steroid hormones are particularly interesting to me and are a subject of great interest up at Rockefeller because they have receptors in almost every nucleated cell in your body. So when your steroids rise and fall, both during gestation and later in life, they affect pretty well everything about you. Your growth, your metabolism, your immune system, your moods, your behavior, the way you think. So these are extremely powerful molecules. And you have to wonder why a single molecule like these steroid hormones would be entrusted with such a broad mandate. And they are because their goal is to, or one of their jobs is to unify our behavior and our brain during archetypal situations in life like fighting, running away, search, feeding, mating. In situations like that, you don't want to be multitasking. You don't want your cardiovascular system geared up for a fight, your stomach in the mood for digesting a turkey dinner, but your brain in the mood for wandering through fields of daffodils. You want all these tissues cooperating on the task at hand. And hormones are one of the molecules or one of the systems in the body that makes sure that all your tissues are cooperating on the task at hand. So to give you an idea of the range of effects of the steroid hormones, steroids are all cleaved from cholesterol. They're sort of four fused carbon rings. They all have the same backbone. We produce about a dozen of them or half a dozen of them, like testosterone, cortisol, which is a stress hormone, estrogen, progesterone. And this gives you an idea of the range of activity of the steroid testosterone. It increases the lean muscle mass in your body. It increases the hemoglobin in your blood, which increases its capacity to carry oxygen. It lowers your voice. In the brain, it increases confidence and appetite for risk. Athletes taking anabolic steroids, of course, are after the first two, which are the lean muscle mass and the hemoglobin. And a lot of the sports science that goes into winning in the Olympics is trying to design a molecule that just has those isolated effects without a lot of the extra effects that you can get from testosterone. And the cat and mouse game between the sports athletes and the IOC is absolutely fascinating. I mean, it's just a great story to tell. So this gives you an idea of the range of tissues affected by this one steroid. Apparently, it's one of the fastest-growing recreational drugs in America. And apparently, aging CEOs who feel the young wolves nipping at their heels have taken to slapping on these testosterone gels. Steroids are like ghosts. They just walk through the walls of your membrane. So you put them on by a gel on your shoulder. It just goes straight through your skin into your blood. And apparently, a lot of these CEOs, aging CEOs, apparently have started slapping this androgel on their shoulders, starting to wear black turtleneck sweaters and thinking outside the box. But when I was at Rockefeller, I came across a really interesting model from animal behavior called the winner effect. Now, in the winner effect initially is one of the most robust findings in animal behavior. It started out as a statistical regularity. An animal that has won a competition or a fight is statistically more likely to win the next fight. And they've replicated this in a large number of species. But there's a question as to what is behind this statistical regularity. And it's sort of interesting that the animal behaviorists would have, on the one hand, have this very, very robust result of the winner effect. And on the other side, economists who will say there's no such thing as a winning streak, that you can't have a hot hand. And it's curious to me that these two groups of researchers have never had it out, so to speak. Because I think the animal behaviorists have got very elegant protocols. Because when they set up these experiments, they control for what they call resource holding potential. And that is the physical resources that an animal can draw on an all-out fight. So in short, their size. But more than size, there are other things like their metabolic rate or whatever. They control for motivation. So you can have a smaller animal beat off a larger animal if they're hungrier. I mean, if a large lion has just fed, he probably doesn't care about this carcass as much as a smaller lion. And they also control for aggression. And it seems that on top of all of this, in controlling for these three factors, there is a residual effect called the winner effect, which comes from winning. So what is the mechanism behind it? And the effect size is quite large. If you can see here, there's a quote from one of the reviews of all the studies. It looks like the winner, their probability of winning a subsequent contest is double. And I think, by the way, that at any rate, so the most powerful explanation for what's going on is a testosterone effect. Yeah.
When you were talking about the paradigm between there's no such a thing as a hot hand, in economics, it's looking at outcomes that are statistically independent from one trial to the other, which I don't think is the case there. It may be that your winner are indeed
right, stronger. But I think economists even dispute that hot hands exist in sports. So the model that they've wedded to the winner effect is another model called the challenge hypothesis, which was developed by a brilliant biologist in Washington named John Wingfield. And putting the two models together, they've come up with a model for what's going on. And the idea is this, that two males go into a competition for turf or a fight, and their testosterone levels rise, which is sort of the role of testosterone. I mean, it increases the hemoglobin in their blood and their confidence, their appetite for risk. The winner of the competition comes out with even higher levels of testosterone. The loser comes out with lower levels. The winner goes into the next round of competition with already elevated levels of testosterone, and this gives him an edge because it's such an energizing hormone. He goes into the next round of competition with an edge, and that gives him a greater chance of winning again. He wins again, he gets another bump up in testosterone, and the thing repeats itself. The loser, on the other hand, has lower levels of testosterone, and he gets onto a losing streak. And they think, by the way, that this feedback loop, I mean, this feedback loop makes sense from an evolutionary point of view, because if you've just lost a fight, your falling testosterone levels are telling you to go off into the woods and nurse your wounds. Don't look for another fight. Whereas if you've just won the fight and you're living in some kind of group, like a baboon, chances are there's going to be more challenges to your increase in rank. So the increased testosterone is preparing you for the increasing challenges that you're going to face. And they think this testosterone feedback loop might actually be the physiological substrate underlying winning and losing streaks in sports. So this is a beautiful model for how winning something could increase your testosterone levels, which in turn increases your appetite for risk. Now, how far can it go? I mean, this is a great model for in the wild. Well, steroids, like most chemicals in your body, display what's called an inverted U-shaped dose response curve. So if you were to plot, say, testosterone or cortisol against, say, some kind of physical task or declarative memory task, at very low levels, you may have very low arousal and you don't do very well. But as these levels of steroids rise, your performance improves until you get to the top of this curve and you're at your optimum level of steroid for performing this task. Now, as your levels rise beyond that level, it starts to impair your performance. And what they found in yet another group of literature from animal behavior is that as this, as the testosterone levels in animals rise, they go over top of this dose response curve and they become overconfident and take on too much risk. So they patrol areas that are too large, they start too many fights, they neglect parenting duties, they spend more time out in the open, they also lose fat stores, which is important for overwintering. And as a result, they suffer increased rates of predation and reduced survival. So at some point, rising levels of testosterone sort of segue into overconfidence and risky behavior. And I thought, this is the perfect model for what's going on Wall Street. This is what I was observing on Wall Street, both in myself and in other traders during the dot-com bubble. They put on a trade, they get it right, they make a lot of money, their testosterone levels rise, they become more confident, they put on larger trades, until at some point they go over top of that inverted U-shaped dose response curve and start putting on terrible trades with terrible risk-reward profiles in large size. And since women have about 10% of the testosterone as men, it may explain why we weren't seeing it in the women. So I thought this was a beautiful model. And this is the model that after a while, working on it both on Wall Street and up at Rockefeller, a few scientists at Rockefeller said, I think you've got something worth testing. You should. So I left Wall Street and went back to Cambridge to join the Department of Physiology and Neuroscience to test this hypothesis, a decision my wife has never forgiven me for. So this was this is a model of what we thought was happening in a bull market. We don't think that testosterone is causing a bull market. I mean, the dot-com bubble was was caused by advances in technology. But a bull market's very different from a bubble. We think what happens is that when a bull market gets going, this testosterone feedback loop is the thing that pushes it over the top into a bubble. Well, what happens when in a crash? Well, we got very interested in another hormone, cortisol, which is the main steroid hormone produced during stress. It's the main stress hormone. It's produced by the adrenal glands, which sit on top of your kidneys. And in times of stress, you produce two, your sympathetic nervous system is the first sort of round of response during the stressful situation. And part of the sympathetic nervous system stimulus is to release adrenaline from the adrenal glands. But in a longer term stressful situation, you also release cortisol. And cortisol is one of the most powerful and toxic chemicals in your body. At low levels, it's euphorogenic. It sort of sharpens arousal, and it's actually a pleasant hormone. I mean, rats will self-stimulate with cortisol. But if you are in, again, with this steroid, as in the others, you've got a dose-response curve, and at low levels, you have one set of effects, and at chronic levels, at high levels, or levels that remain for a long period of time, you have a completely different set of results. And one of the things that cortisol does, together with the other stress hormone, adrenaline, is that in an emergency situation, it shuts down all long-term functions of your body. Because if you're faced with a grizzly on hind legs, you don't need to be reproducing. You don't need a reproductive tract to be in order. You don't need an immune system. You don't need, well, that's a complicated one. I won't get into that. I'll get into that a bit later. You don't need to digest. And so it shuts down a lot of these long-term functions of the body, and it marshals glucose for immediate use. So cortisol basically has one main command. I need glucose now. Anything that isn't giving me glucose, shut it down, and then start breaking down all the energy stores in my body so that I've got use. So it flushes glucose into your blood from your liver. It breaks down amino acids from your muscles, and it breaks down the fat stores into free fatty acids, which is extremely useful. Now, again, the difference between acute and chronic. The acute exposure to cortisol gives you motivation of focused attention. But if a stress response lingers, and your exposure to cortisol lingers, it starts having devastating effects on both your body and brain. Because your digestive system has been shut down, you're more liable to get peptic ulcers. Your immune system has been inhibited, so you're more liable to get recurrent virus flare-ups and upper respiratory illnesses. You can't have sex. You get cuts. They don't heal. You stop growing. I mean, it's a terrible... I mean, the effects of it are terrible. Now, for the purposes of this research, what is more interesting are the effects it has on the brain. Because a chronic exposure to cortisol starts affecting... by stimulating CRH gene transcription, the central nucleus of the amygdala, it instills anxiety within people. It causes you to develop a selective attention to negative precedents. It changes the memories you recall. Both the stress hormones are used to encode what they call flashbulb memories. So if you encounter that grizzly on hind legs, you have a car accident, if you remember 9/11, the stress hormones tag these events for special storage, the idea being that they're important events to remember later on in life. These are things that you really should learn from, too, so you can avoid them next time. And what happens later on when you have chronically elevated levels of cortisol is that the types of memories you recall start to change. You tend to recall mostly negative precedents. So we think that all these effects on the brain, in terms of producing anxiety, a sort of pervasive fear of the world, and a selective recall of negative memories, we think that instills risk aversion amongst the traders. So that's the model we had for what takes place during a bear market, that the cortisol levels rise powerfully in these traders and instill risk aversion. So we think it's possible that with the same exact imagine having identical sets of facts, market facts, a trader ripped on high levels of testosterone may see only opportunity in these facts. But the same set of facts with the same trader with chronically high levels of cortisol may see only danger in the facts. So we think that there's nothing objective about information, that really the way these traders are interpreting information really depends on which hormone, in a sense, is in the ascendancy. and how high they are. We think that these hormones can get high enough, so high during bubbles and crashes, that these traders effectively become price insensitive. So that's the hypothesis. So we think there's the flip side of the winner effect of testosterone is a loser effect with cortisol. So that's the big hypothesis, that steroid hormones are building up in the bodies of traders during both bull markets and bear markets, causing them to become, shifting their risk preferences pro-cyclically and destabilizing the financial market. Now, that's a big hypothesis. That's a really tough, that's a big one to prove. We actually have a fairly large grant designed to help us try and prove it, but even with these resources, it's a tough one. All we could do is try and get preliminary data. So we conducted a series of three experiments on this trading floor in the city. Being an ex-trader, I found it quite easy to get us back on a trading floor. And this is the trading floor I got us on. It was 250 traders, all but three are males, most of the traders in their 20s, and that's about right all across the financial world. It's young males, I'd say maybe 3% women on the trading floors. These guys were a particular type of traders. They were called high-frequency traders, meaning that they don't position their trades for long periods of time. They trade the noise about the trend. They're in and out. Sometimes they're in and out in 30 seconds. And they rarely position overnight. So also this trading floor is a state of nature. These guys only have their trading profits, profit sharing. They have no salary. They have no year-end bonus. I mean, I've seen traders at Goldman Sachs who couldn't make a penny, but they played tennis with the boss, and they became partners, and were taking home about $20 million a year, and they could not make a penny. That doesn't exist here. There's no sucking up to the boss here. That doesn't work. There's no year-end. And also what happens on Wall Street, if you haven't done well, but the firm has done well, they'll give you a bonus just because the firm has done well. It doesn't take place here. So on this trading floor, selection happens very quickly. If you don't make money, you're out. It's as simple as that. They're not brutal about it. They support you. But they also don't think it's in your interest to stick around if you have no future in it. The other thing I should mention is that they're probably the best traders I've ever come across. I have to confess that I went onto this trading floor, which I'd never heard of at the time, a bit of a snot. Because coming from fixed income derivatives at Goldman Sachs, which is where Fisher Black was and a lot of their other big names, I felt a bit like superior. And I quickly realized that most of the traders at Goldman Sachs really make their money because they've got Mother Goldman behind them. They've got, you know, unlimited amount of capital, but more importantly, they have an enormous sales force. So someone who's trading like a 10-year treasury bond will sit in that seat and make $50 million a year. But it's all coming from the sales force because they're getting the bid-offer spread of all the flows coming in from around the world. The Bank of China coming in and selling them a billion tens. DuPont Pension Fund coming in and asking you to offer a billion tens. They take out that bid-offer spread. They look like heroes. And a lot of these guys get big names for themselves on the street and are then offered capital to set up a hedge fund. And I know six of them, and they've all been bankrupt within 2 years because without that sales force and without that amount of capital behind them, they can't make money. These guys can. There's no gimmies. They have no sales force. So I was just blown away by them. There were a couple of guys there who were making $25 million a year just trading. Nothing. No client flows, nothing. I mean, and no edge in information or anything. I was just blown away. They were the most disciplined traders. They get themselves into a hole. They pull the plug on their trades and they sit on their hands until they're out of it, until they feel they've caught the thread of the market again, and then they go back in. So they were an amazing bunch of guys. So what we did is we set up on the floor and started taking steroid samples from them. And the data was extraordinary. The data was absolutely extraordinary. This is a fantastic laboratory for a number of reasons, but one of them is that a lot of work in behavioral endocrinology, the dependent variables are so fuzzy. It's like aggression, dominance behavior, status-seeking behavior, they're very hard to measure. And so it's not surprising that these papers quite often have borderline significant results and one paper will contradict the other. There's just a hell of a lot of noise in their data. This, we had P&L, which is profit and loss. That just comes from the back office. Volatility of the market, that's just a number you take out of the market. Implied volatility, you back out from options prices. The size of their positions, again, is just taken from back office. It's all very hard data. And I think it accounts for, as you'll see, the strength of the data. So what we did find was that when these traders were making an above-average profit, in other words, more than they're used to making, their testosterone levels were, in fact, higher, significantly higher than when they were just having an average day. So that was an interesting start, but it doesn't tell you which way the correlation is going. Are the profits causing the hormones increase or the other way around? We think it's a feedback, but with the data we had, since we were sampling in the morning and the afternoon, we could also do some disentangling. And what we found was that we looked at their testosterone levels in the morning. So what we have here are the 17 traders in the study, and these are their P&Ls when they had low testosterone in the morning. In other words, low relative to their median during the study. And then what we did is compared it to the P&L when their testosterone levels in the morning were high. And you can see that the difference between these two sets of days is significant to three decimal places. But more importantly, it's a huge effect size. It's a full standard deviation. For some of these guys, that was a difference in take-home pay of almost £1 million a year. So this is an enormous effect size. And also another noticeable thing about this data is you'll notice that it holds for pretty well every single trader. I mean, normally in human biology, you will get, you know, some people with a big effect, some people with a small effect, a bunch with no effect at all, some with the opposite effect. These guys, 15 out of 17, had the same, a similar effect. The only two that didn't have it were trivial. I mean, they were just basically flat. There was no difference between the two sets of days. So in terms of human biology, this is a really strong result. I think if I were to redo the paper, I wouldn't do the data this way because a median split is a bit arbitrary. Just out of interest, after I published the paper and realized that, I reran it using panel data, and you get very similar, as you would expect, you get pretty good results no matter how you run it. So this result got an enormous amount of press coverage, as you can imagine, because this paper came out right in the middle of the credit crisis. And The Economist ran an article saying that maybe traders should get up in the morning, test themselves for testosterone, and don't bother going in if they've got low levels. Now, we did a second study. When I was on the trading floor, there's sort of a standard model in endocrinology called the organizational activational model, according to which your sensitivity as an adult to changes in circulating levels of a steroid hormone are a function of how much of that steroid you were exposed to prenatally during gestation. And the model is used mostly with testosterone, with androgens. And the idea behind it being that you have these, for example, in male fetuses, there's this surge of androgens between the 8th and the 19th week, which has a pronounced effect on how that fetus turns out as an adult. And basically, these androgens during this androgen surge are setting up all this circuitry in their bodies that will later, and then the androgens go quiescent for until puberty, and the testosterone comes rushing back in and activates all these circuits. And the idea being that later in life, your sensitivity to the testosterone is a function of how much testosterone you're exposed to during gestation. Now, during this androgen surge, you know, as you can imagine, pretty well everything in a male body is affected by it. But there's a number of physical features of your body that can be used as a gauge, allowing you to read back what the levels of androgens were you were exposed to prenatally, just like a high water mark on a breakwater or something. And these markers are all really weird ones. For example, autoacoustic emissions, which are these inaudible sonar-like clickings in your inner ear. And the frequency of those clickings apparently are correlated with androgens. I mean, that's pretty weird. Ridge count asymmetry between your hands. I mean, how do they find out these things? And one of the most popular ones for behavioral studies is this one, which is 2D4D. And that's the ratio of your index finger to your ring finger. And the lower this ratio, in other words, the shorter this finger relative to this finger, the more androgens you've been exposed to prenatally. And this measure has been used, I mean, there's a lot of very good studies showing that this thing predicts athletic ability. extremely well, and that when you get, I mean, when you look at the hands of Olympic athletes, their index finger looks like a bloody cigar stub. I mean, it's freaky. So, I mean, I'd read about this, and I didn't put much stock in it. But while I was on the trading floor, I thought, it doesn't cost anything to take a handprint. So we took handprints on the original study, and I just about fell off my chair when I saw the results because it correlated with their P&L. So we started building up the study, and the correlation held. And when we realized the data was so strong that we really had to publish it, we were still really uncomfortable in this because it really looks like one step up from palmistry. And my main colleague is a clinical endocrinologist, a very respected one. Whenever I see him, he's got a room, waiting room full of patients. And he's a rising star in molecular biology. And I had to say, I said, Mark, are you sure you want your name on this paper? I mean, this is just, we have to make sure that this isn't going to destroy your reputation. I don't have much fun. I'm a bond trader, for Christ's sake. But you do. And so we took a deep look into the science. I mean, it's a difficult thing to prove. There's some decent science. We decided on the bulk of considerations it was okay. My reasons for doing it, for publishing it, had nothing to do with the research showing the credibility of 2D, 4D. My reasons were other. And that is that there is one marker that has universal acceptance, pretty well universal acceptance. It's used in a lot of hospitals now, such as Addenbrooke's Hospital at Cambridge, on newborns to gauge their exposure, to find out whether they've been exposed to an abnormal level of prenatal steroids. And the reason for that is that, as you probably know, there is in the past 3 decades an increasing incidence of testicular dysgenesis syndrome, which is undistended testicles, urethra improperly placed or abnormally placed, future testicular cancer, low sperm count. And they think this is due to the increasing presence of environmental hormone disruptors. So it's sort of important for medicine to be able to gauge whether a newborn has been exposed to an abnormal steroid environment. So it's important for them to find a marker like this that works. And the one they found that has been, they've been proven to be have a good track record is another really weird one. It's anogenital distance, which is now routinely measured in newborns in a number of hospitals. And we laughed about thinking trying to get anogenital distance out of the traders. And someone suggested putting a copy machine in the middle of the Christmas office party. We'd probably get some samples then, but we didn't think that we'd have the subject ID with it. But my thinking was that if there is one, and AGD has been sort of validated through pharmacological studies with rodents and other animals, so my thinking was if there's one marker that is accepted in clinical practice, then why couldn't there be another one? So that was my reason. The other reason, mainly for all of us, was that the data was so strong we had to publish it. So this is what happened when we plotted the traders 2D, 4D against their P&L. And as you can see, it's quite a strong, for human biology, that's a very strong result. And this is their predicting their P&L over a 2-year period. So, and it sort of, I mean, it was nice to have this sort of mesh with the organizational activational model. We had the activational effects of circulating testosterone increasing short-term profits of the traders, and now it looks like prenatal or organizing effects of androgens were increasing their lifetime profitability as traders, because it also predicted how long they remained in the business. And we only had 2 years of P&L for these guys, but we also had the number of years they were in the business. And their 2D40 predicted their survival in the business. I mean, it was extraordinary data. Okay, so what the hell's going on here? What is causing the higher? How can a molecule translate into profits? I mean, according to economics, or an influential school of economics, the markets are random. Nobody can outperform in the market. No one can be better. It doesn't matter how smart you are, how fast you are. There's nothing that can help you beat a random market. Anyway, you can't get better at flipping coins or rolling dice. So if intelligence doesn't help you beat the market, how the hell can a molecule? I mean, I think these results really caused a lot of people to scratch their heads. So there's a number of ways it can be affecting these traders. It turns out these traders have what you might call a set point or a fixed point of risk preference. they have a size of trade that they're comfortable with. It might be 100 million long bonds, it might be a billion long bonds, and they don't go beyond that. And quite often these guys are getting the market right 8, 9 times out of 10, and management's saying, up your size, you mean trade more, you can make more money, and if they do, they kind of fall apart. So we think one of the things that might be happening is if testosterone is increasing their confidence or their risk preferences, and that's causing them to up their trading size, and if they have positive expected return, then anything that causes them to take slightly larger positions in the market is also going to make them make more money. So maybe that's what's going on. Another possibility, which is even more intriguing, is that it's rarely appreciated that trading is a physical activity. I think most in finance and economics, I think most people think it's a cognitive activity. But it's also a physical activity. These guys have to scan the screens for price anomalies for hours at a time. And that's exhausting. Not everyone can do it. And they have to be good at spotting price discrepancies. And when they spot the price discrepancies, they have to jump on it before another person does. So there's a huge physical element to this trading. In fact, most types of trading that go unappreciated. So it's entirely possible that the androgens were increasing their acuity of visual motor scanning or their physical reactions. Basically, it's like a branch of sports. So these guys are like tennis players at net. I mean, when you see them when they're trading, they really look like tennis players at net. So that might be going on. And that's interesting. Because I don't think anyone would consider that biological traits may actually contribute to survival in the markets. So in a third study, we tried to figure out which of these it was. Is it promoting just increased risk or increased skill? Well, to do that, you really have to get into pharmacology, which is what we're doing now. And pharmacology with hormones is not something I'd wish on anybody. It's just hormones are the devil's molecule to work with. It is just, they're just impossible to work with. They change over the course of the day. They change over the course of the year. They change over the course of your life. There's crosstalk between the receptors. I mean, they're just, if you administer a steroid to a human in the hope of like increasing their testosterone or cortisol levels, what happens is that their body downregulates its own production and you're nowhere. So you've got to like completely suppress the domestic production of these hormones and then take control of the person's hormones pharmacologically. And as you can imagine, first of all, getting ethical approval is, I mean, you can do it. I mean, as long as you're working with good endocrinologists, they do things like this quite often, but it's an absolute nightmare. Then you need a 10-day washout period before you do the control part of the study, and then you get into women who have twice the number of active hormones as men. It's just, you know, stick to something else. But at any rate, so that's what you do, pharmacology, but it turns out we could actually get a good start at it by doing another study using what they call sharp ratios. Now, the idea behind a sharp ratio, in fact, we probably should have been using sharp ratios all along. P&L by itself does not tell you if a trader is good or not. A trader that's made $100 million is considered a good trader. But if that trader could just as easily have lost $500 million, he's not a good trader. He's lucky. And I think we all just found that out to the expense of the taxpayers, that these guys that everyone thought were like geniuses, we're not. They were just rolling the dice. Sharp ratios take that into account in the sense that you take someone's P&L and you divide it by the variance of their P&L so that you get risk-adjusted P&L. And that's a much more sensitive measure of someone's trading skill. And so when a trader is looking for a job, the first thing people say is, what's your Sharpe ratio? When a hedge fund is looking for capital, the first thing they tell investors what their Sharpe ratio is. So we took a look at this 2D, 4D against Sharpe ratios, thinking that this way we could distinguish whether it was predicting skill or risk. And it wasn't predicting skill. It was predicting the risk, which is sort of what you'd expect. So that led to that makes sense. It makes sense of the findings so far that testosterone should be increasing the amount of risk they take. But then it led to another problem. These guys are incredible traders. They have Sharpe ratios greater than 1. A Sharpe ratio greater than 1 is the gold standard in hedge funds. If you have a Sharpe ratio above 1, you can attract capital. During this period, generally, economics will tell you that traders and hedge funds should not outperform the broad market. The DAX, which was their benchmark index, had a Sharpe ratio during the study of about 0.35, which is about the long-term Sharpe ratio of a stock market, both the S&P and the DAX. But these experienced traders had Sharpe ratios over 1, so they were outperforming the market. And according to economics, they shouldn't. So it's sort of strange. If the testosterone was increasing the amount of risk they were taking, you'd think that could just as easily create a rogue trader. So why are these guys also got high Sharpe ratios? That was a bit of a mystery. Well, it turns out we plotted their Sharpe ratios against the number of years they've been trading, and we got a very strong result. It turns out that their Sharpe ratios were increasing the longer they had been trading. And this is robust progression. It may look like these figures, these numbers down here and up there are skewing it, but that's robust progression, so it's taking into account the outliers. And in fact, if you take out the outliers and just do OLS, you get an even stronger result. So it was a really powerful, another very powerful result. So what's going on? I mean, this graph could be coming from one of two ways. Maybe everybody is born with a Sharpe ratio, and the draconian management practices of this trading floor means that if you've got a low Sharpe ratio, you get fired. So after a while, you only have high Sharpe ratio traders surviving. Alternatively, each person's Sharpe ratio could be increasing over time. So this could be the product of selection or learning. So what we did with each individual trader is we looked at the evolution of their Sharpe ratio over the study, over the 20-month period, or the two-year period. And everyone's Sharpe ratio, or the average Sharpe ratio of all the traders, was increasing over the 2 years of the trading, so it was learning. And now, for the non-finance and the economics people in the audience, that may strike you as, yeah, so what? Why wouldn't you improve? Why wouldn't you learn as you do your job? You learn at everything. You learn at law. You learn at medicine. Why wouldn't you learn at trading? Well, you're not supposed to, according to economics. The markets are random, so you shouldn't be learning. So this is a really interesting result. In fact, believe it or not, we think it's the first paper to show learning in the financial markets. I know Robert Shiller, that great economist from Yale, who coined the term irrational exuberance. In that book, Irrational Exuberance, he spends a lot of time looking for evidence of traders who have learned. And he could only come up with one paper of day traders on the Taiwan Stock Exchange, but it's not a very robust paper. And so we think this is actually the first one that shows that you can beat the market. It's sort of not surprising from a common sense point of view, but from the point of view of economics, it's sort of heresy. So from the efficient markets hypothesis, they say that if the markets are random, you can't say in advance. Some people can outperform the market, just as some people can flip 10 heads in a row, but you can't say in advance who it is. But it looks like from these biomarkers that you can, and nor should learning take place in a market that's random. But these Sharpe ratios were increasing over time. So what we're seeing on these three across these three studies is we're starting to see how the biology, the management, and the compensation schemes work together. It's not like there's a biological trait that says that person's going to be a good trader. You know, that's kind of futuristic. I know a lot of people like publishing papers and saying, you know, if you've got this polymorphism of the serotonin transporter gene, you're going to be good at managing risk. But it's just nonsense. I mean, you're always going to expect nature and nurture to work together. And across these three experiments, I think we're starting to see how the management on the and the compensation schemes on this floor actually work with the biology of the traders to produce traders that work really well. And one thing that came out of this study, which we think, we published this before Christmas, and we were really hoping it might actually be used by the banks. We know that you can't tell whether, when you're going to allocate capital and bonuses in the banks, you know you can't, and we know you can no longer trust a trader's P&L, how much money they've made, because it might just be them rolling the dice. So a lot of people started to use Sharpe ratios, which is a better measure. But Sharpe ratios are also a stochastic measure as well, and you can, through luck, have a high Sharpe ratio. One thing we don't think can be luck is the slope of a trader's Sharpe ratio plotted against how many years they're trading. And we think this is the measure that banks should be using and investors should be using to judge whether a hedge fund or a trader is actually skilled versus whether they're just lucky, whether their Sharpe ratios are increasing over time. Because then you know the results are probably the result of skill rather than luck. And I think it's just a great measure. I really would be happy if the financial world started using this measure.
Is it interacting in any way with the hormonal indicator of hormonal variability?
Well, I'll get to that in the end. Okay, so what about cortisol? Well, we were expecting the cortisol levels of these traders to go up when they were losing money. In fact, it didn't work out that way because they didn't lose any money. Some of them did. But they didn't lose very much, and they're so well disciplined, and the risk management is so draconian that when they start losing money, they just sit on their hands. So we didn't catch anyone on a losing streak. I think if we did, certainly you'd see their cortisol levels go up. What we found, though, was, in a sense, much more interesting. Because cortisol has been found, when Hans Selle here at McGill sort of discovered the stress response and the role of cortisol in the stress response, he was focusing mostly on actual aversive stimuli, an injury, a toxin, low blood sugar, something like that. But it was later found out that cortisol can have even higher, you can have even a more pronounced cortisol response to certain psychological conditions or conditions you find yourself in particular conditions of novelty, uncontrollability, and uncertainty. So, for example, if you put a rat in a new cage, its cortisol levels will go up. Even though nothing is overtly threatening in the new cage and nothing bad has happened to it, but it's new. It doesn't know what to expect. And given that cortisol's role is to marshal glucose for expected challenge, its cortisol levels to go up to help marshal glucose and prepare them for the unexpected. Uncontrollability. That's a very potent influence on during a stressful situation. They've established that that's a potent influence on cortisol levels through a series of what they call yoked experiments. So if you yoke two animals together so that they're each getting mild shocks, but one of the animals can press a bar lever to stop the shock, then at the end of the experiment, both animals will have been exposed to the identical levels of aversive stimuli. But the one that can press the bar lever might have normal cortisol levels, but the one that has no control has extremely elevated levels of cortisol. So uncontrollability in itself is a potent influence on cortisol levels. And lastly, uncertainty. A very elegant series of experiments done in the 70s by John Hennessy and Seymour Levine administered mild shocks to rats and according to a fixed schedule, like every couple of minutes, or they announced the shock with an audible tone. And once the rats got used to this schedule, at the end of the experiment, they might actually have mildly elevated cortisol levels or even unchanged cortisol levels. So the aversive stimuli itself wasn't enough to get the cortisol levels up. When they started altering the timing of these shocks, so they became harder and harder to predict, their cortisol levels started rising, and they reached a maximum when the shocks were being delivered in a completely random order, so there was no predictability, it was completely uncertain when they were going to get the shock, that's when their cortisol levels hit a maximum. So uncertainty, uncontrollable novelty, can elicit higher cortisol response than actual harm. Those three properties, novelty, uncontrollability, uncertainty, as you can imagine, that defines the life of a trader. So we wondered, how do we measure uncertainty in traders? Well, it turns out it's actually very easy. Implied volatility. Because implied volatility in the derivatives market is the market's collective assessment of how much the market's going to be moving in the next little while. So if you're not expecting anything to happen in the market, implied volatility is very low. But when everyone is completely uncertain, they have no clue what's going to happen, implied volatility skyrockets. And this is the VIX, which is an index of implied volatilities on the New York Stock Exchange. It's called the fear index. So during the credit crisis, this went from about 10% to 80%, which displayed historically high levels of uncertainty about what the hell was going on, as you would expect. So what we did was their uncontrollability. What we found then was that the traders' cortisol levels were going up with the volatility of their P&L. as you would expect, because the more volatile their P&L is, the less control they have over it. So not surprising their cortisol levels were going up as their trading was more uncontrollable. But then what we did to see the effect of the market's uncertainty about the future, we timed the study so that it was going across the most important economic releases in the American economic calendar, most important of which is the employment report, which is reported on the first Friday of every month, and the ISM Purchasing Managers Index, which is the last day of the month. So that week is the most important week of the month for traders, and quite often traders will make their whole month's P&L during that week and sometimes just on the day of unemployment. So on those days, the traders, the atmosphere on the trading floor is electric. And people all around the world stay up for it. Even Japan, China, Europe, everyone is awake for these numbers. So these are day weights. This is the added volatility in the German bond market, but you'd find this in any bond market because these guys mostly traded German bonds. This is the added volatility you're expecting on these days based on the economic statistics being released. This is implied volatility of the Bund contract overlaying on these days events. And as you can see, it's a perfect fit. The more important the economic announcement, the more volatility, the more uncertainty about where the market's going to go. So what we wanted to know is if the trader's cortisol levels would follow the uncertainty that is shown in the implied volatility of this bond contract. And what we found, I'm sorry, this changes format. You can see it's the same thing but in a different format. The top line are the cortisol levels averaged across all traders, plotted against the implied volatility of the German bond market, which was the main market they traded. As you can see, it's almost a perfect fit. It's an R squared of 86, which is absolutely extraordinary. So it raises the possibility that cortisol is the biological substrate of the derivatives market. Now, I mean, as a former derivative trader, I just love this result. Now, there's a number of other things too. So it looked like their cortisol levels were rising with the uncontrollability of their trading results and uncertainty in the market. And I want you to look at the size of the effects, because we did this experiment during a really boring period in the market. There was nothing going on. And steroids spike up in the morning. They're sort of your morning wake-up call, your body's wake-up call, or your morning cup of coffee, and then they decline over the course of the day. So during our sampling times, we should have seen these steroids drop about 50%. But in some of our traders, we were seeing these steroids rise 500%. Their cortisol levels rise 500% from morning to afternoon, and this in a boring market. So this, again, was a very boring two-week period. But as you can see, the cortisol levels of all the traders averaged went up almost 70% over the course of this week, which is an enormous. I mean, we're getting into clinical territory here. And some of the cortisol levels we saw in individual traders are ones you don't normally see except in clinical patients. I mean, in patients with Cushing syndrome, which are tumors of the adrenals that overproduce cortisol. And this in a boring market. We, of course, wanted to sample during the credit crisis, but, you know, interest in this research evaporates when everyone is just concerned about their jobs, so we couldn't get our invitations to go back onto trading floors disappeared during the credit crisis, which was heartbreaking for me. But my guess is that if we were seeing cortisol increases of this magnitude during a boring period of the market, I cannot imagine what they were like during the credit crisis. Now, here's a nice little slide that shows both these steroids in action. This was a trader who was flat at 11 in the morning, meaning his P&L was zero. By 2:30 in the afternoon, he had hit his maximum allowable daily loss. So his testosterone levels were down, his cortisol levels were up, given the volatility of his P&L. He was told to close out his positions and go home. He came over and said, "I better give my sample now, I have to go home." He did. He went back to his desk and decided to stay. And he traded out of the hole and actually ended up having a record day. His testosterone levels went right back up, and given the volatility of his P&L, his cortisol levels kept rising. So that's kind of a nice snapshot of what's going on with a trader's hormones during the course of the day. Now, there's something else that we think was probably taking place during the credit crisis, besides the uncontrollability in their trading results and the uncertainty in the market. Sapolsky has found that if you expose a group of monkeys to an uncontrollable stressor, actually, I don't think it was an experiment, he just observed it. the dominant monkey will take to biting the subordinates. And horribly, it works. Their cortisol levels go back down to zero, and the subordinates' cortisol levels go through the roof. And I think the same thing happens in banks during crises, because I think middle management is basically offloading its cortisol onto their juniors, because you see a lot of unnecessary threatening and bullying during crises that just terrify the juniors on the floor, and it's unnecessary. And it's these middle management basically doing what these dominant monkeys doing, offloading their cortisol. This cortisol at those levels is not a pleasant experience. They're just basically, here, you take my cortisol. And of all the things management can do during a crisis, because if cortisol, as we suspect, is diminishing risk, increasing risk aversion amongst traders during a crash, you want to do whatever you can to lower cortisol levels on the floor. And this is one very easy way. And this is probably one of the most potent effects on traders. The uncertainty that comes from thinking you're going to be laid off or that you're going to have part of your trading responsibilities taken away from you. And this one is very easy. The illusion of control can actually lower cortisol levels. They should be giving these traders the illusion that they're still in control of their careers, even if they're not. So we think that during the credit crisis, steroid levels were so high that these guys became completely price averse, price insensitive and risk averse. And it may these steroid feedback loops may explain why central banks have had so little luck at stopping a bubble or curing a crash. We think basically at the peak of a bubble and at the pit of a crash, the financial community is basically turning into a pathological community, a clinical community, and that they have to be seen in that light because they are no longer rational economic agents. And unfortunately, most of economics is based on the idea that price signals are sufficient when dealing with rational economic agents. So the idea then, as I said before, that the information that traders, how they interpret information, is not objective. It depends on how high their steroid levels are. And one thing I want to go back to before is the level of the... I'm not going to go back. So what do you do if price signals aren't the answer? Well, I guess I'll go on to the concluding... Well, one thing we did find, I've got this fascinating collaboration going with UK Sport, which is the organization that trains the British Olympic team. Why they're talking to a Canadian, I have no idea. Unless, of course, they're giving me misinformation, hoping I pass it on to the Canadian Olympic team. But what they're figuring out about hormones is absolutely fascinating, and it'll never be published because it's not in their interest to publish it. But what we figured out is that the Olympic athletes and the really good traders on the floor have very similar endocrine profiles in that you would expect them to have muted emotions, muted hormonal surges, but it's not the case. The good traders on the floor had poker faces. They sat there. You couldn't tell that there was anything going on. They looked like Federer or Tiger Woods. Well, at least not Tiger Woods now, but before. And their hormones were on fire. I mean, just on fire. But the difference is, and what they found with athletes, the difference between an elite athlete and an amateur is that the elite athletes get these spikes in testosterone and cortisol when they need them, and then they immediately go right back down because the steroids do their damage when they go up and they linger. And the difference is that the amateurs don't get the spikes as high, but then their steroids linger, and that's when they start impairing their performance and their recovery time. And we found out that the good traders had very similar endocrine profiles in that respect. They had high spikes in steroids, but they returned to baseline very quickly when they needed to. And it raises the possibility that traders could actually learn, management at banks could actually learn a lot from training regimes of athletes in how to control these hormonal surges. Because, I mean, in the first instance, I don't think anyone in the banks, until these papers came out, had any idea that this was going on. But since the papers came out, I've had email from so many traders saying, now I understand. I mean, any trader listening to this would be nodding, going, because they've experienced these surges. They just didn't know they were hormones. So we like this. There's a lot of research now in neuroeconomics. People, for example, there's one great paper showing that the nucleus accumbens fires up in anticipation of irrational risk-seeking decisions, and the insula fires up in anticipation of irrational risk aversion. And neuroeconomics is very interesting for coming up with conclusions like that, but we don't know why the nucleus accumbens would fire up. But the beauty about hormones is that they kind of provide the missing link in this literature between market events and what's going on in the brain. Because it turns out that in all the parts of the brain that have been identified by neuroeconomics as being responsible for deviations from rational choice, areas like the insula, the nucleus accumbens, the amygdala, of course, they're areas of the brain that are that either have steroid receptors or are affected by steroids in some ways. So we think that as these steroid levels wax and wane, they're the things that are like causing these brain regions to fire up or stop firing, whatever. So I think it's important that we start putting together the work on steroid hormones with the really fascinating work, in particular being done on dopamine. If, in fact, our body is having an enormous influence on the behavior of traders, then price signals and all the policies that are designed are based on rational economic agents may be missing the mark, that risk management should be teaching these traders or being aware that these hormonal surges are taking place in the traders. And in particular, they should be looking for traders on winning streaks, because risk management tends to look at traders who aren't very good traders and maybe losing a bit of money. They're not the people you have to worry about. The people you have to worry about are the stars. Whenever Goldman Sachs or Morgan Stanley wakes up and finds that, unbeknownst to them, they've just lost $2 billion, it's a star that's just done that. It's a former trader that they could do no wrong, whose risk limits have been constantly raised, who's been making tons of money. They're the one who are susceptible to this winner effect and going over top of the dose response curve. Those are the people risk management should be watching. And there should be something like a rain break. If someone's having like an incredible winning streak, they should say, that's great. Now close it out and go on holiday for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, break up this thing. Also, as I've mentioned before, I think the management structure of the banks has to take into account the fact that middle management is exacerbating the risk aversion amongst the traders during crises. But more importantly, we have to get beyond price signals as a policy. And if hormones, in fact, are causing these bubbles, and it's entirely possible that bubbles are a young male phenomenon, and one way to get around that is to have more women and older men in the banks. Men, your testosterone levels fall over the course of your life. So older men have a lot lower levels than young men. Women have about 10% of the testosterone as men, so they're probably not susceptible to the winner effect. They have the same amount of cortisol as men, and their cortisol is as reactive. But there's a couple of good papers that suggest that their cortisol responds to different sorts of events. They seem to respond more to social stressors than they do competitive stressors. So it's entirely possible that within the financial markets, men are more hormonal than women, which I think is a conclusion that comes as something of a shock to most men. But having lived it and having seen how immune women were during the dot-com bubble to the siren song of the NASDAQ, I tend to believe it. So I think on that optimistic note, I'm going to stop. Yeah.
Like you mentioned randomness a few times. I mean, even if the markets are random, there may be periods of time where trends continue. And if the trader, part of his aptitude is to pick up on that trend, especially if they're doing short-term trades, you're going to get trends and maybe the testosterone accentuates the ability to spot those things, and that's why they do so well. But this randomness may be correct over a longer period of time, short time.
Yeah, I think it's an accurate description of the market to say it's trends with noise and the occasional break. I think that's what the market is. So yeah, I mean, we ended up finding that risk, that it was, that the testosterone, at least if you believe this marker, that it was mostly affecting risk, but that doesn't mean I don't think the other things were also involved. So the type of college, I mean, we had, there's a couple of really good papers on search patterns, showing how testosterone affects search patterns. And I think that may, I mean, there's a really interesting experiment to be formed there, which I think is that would probably get closer to the point you're making, if in fact it was affecting, if it was in fact endowing them with a search pattern that enabled them to latch onto these trends. Yeah. By the way, when I say the market is random, I don't say the market's random. I say economics says the market's random. It's a bit different.
Yeah, I think that. No.
Yeah.
What kind of equipment do you need to test the testosterone level? Is it a big lab, or you can do it?
It's actually, it used to be difficult. It's now really easy. I'll briefly explain how they do it because it's so cool. The guy who thought this up got a Nobel Prize. So you've got, you used to have to take it from serum, which is a bit difficult because if you take blood from someone, their cortisol levels kind of go up. And then you don't know whether you've got the real cortisol levels. And Sapolsky, it's sort of interesting, when Sapolsky samples cortisol from his baboons in Kenya, he's got a blow dart. And he, I was thinking of doing that to the traders on the floor. and when he darts a baboon, obviously a baboon that's just been darted, its cortisol levels are going to skyrocket. But I think the tranquilizer kicks in about 30 seconds. And you've got 3 minutes before the surge of cortisol gets from their adrenal glands into the blood. And so he's got 3 minutes to take his sample. And he knows that it hasn't been affected. That doesn't answer your question. You get it from saliva. There's assays that get it from saliva. And what they do is they put the saliva that you've taken in a test tube lined with antibodies for testosterone. And they put in the sample that you've got with a sample of radioactive testosterone. And the two samples compete to bind to the antibodies. And then they just put it in a gamma counter. And the more testosterone there is in your sample, the lower the gamma count's going to be, because the more those molecules are going to bind to the antibodies. I think it's just a beautiful, the guy who thought that up, I think it's just, he got a Nobel Prize for that. So yeah, you can actually just take the saliva samples now and send it away to labs, and they will do.
It takes a few days, or it's a question of a few hours.
Oh, you mean, are you saying, can you do it on the floor?
If you can design a system who sits next to the risk manager, and every day he takes a sample of his drug,
and
incorporate this with his risk management techniques?
Yeah, we're looking at that.
You can patent the thing.
Thing is,
it has to be assayed in some way.
Yeah, well, there's a machine that can do cortisol in 10 minutes, but you need it from serum, which is a bit more difficult. You can't have a bunch of traders with catheters in their arm.
But that's the next step, I guess.
Yes, I know people who are working on the technology. One kind of nice thing about doing this and it getting a lot of press coverage is that everybody who's working on anything like this feels they have to get in touch with me, so I see everything. So yes, people are working on that. Yeah.
Is there a base rate difference in just average T levels for traders versus norms?
We didn't look at that. It's really difficult to do between subject comparisons with steroids, because the band of what is normal is really wide, and sampling is really noisy because steroids are released in pulses. So a lot of experiments take like a single sample, but you don't know. I mean, if you take a sample that's just after you've got a pulse, you're going to get a really high level, And if it's 20 minutes later, just before the next pulse kicks in, you might have a really low level. So it's very difficult. You're supposed to do seven samples. The state of the art is to do seven samples over the course of the day and use area under curve. I think you can get away with three. We looked at 2D40 relative to the population. These guys had just slightly lower 2D40s than the population. Slightly lower.
Okay. My follow-up would be the few women that are traders, are they the outliers in the T dimension?
Don't know yet. We're trying to recruit women risk takers right now. The thing is, I mean, it's a really interesting question why women aren't on trading floors. There's literature saying that they're more risk-averse than men, but I don't believe that because in London, in the city, if you go onto these types of trading floors, this and the investment banks, you'll see about 3% women. And that's even with like a massive push by the banks for diversity. I mean, these investment banks want women traders, but women don't want to do these traders. I know people who hire at these banks, and whenever they hire a woman, they say, "Do you want to trade?" And they say, "No." So it's not a glass ceiling or anything like that. And yet, if you go from this style of trading, which is very high frequency, to asset management, like in Britain, the big asset managers like Alliance Trust, Scottish Widows, Aviva, there's 60% women. And that's risk-taking. It's just, so I think if you want to figure out what's going on with men and women in the financial world, I don't think you're getting at it by looking at what's saying, well, one's risk-averse and one's risk-loving. I think they're both, you have to look at why one prefers one type of risk and why a different type. Yeah.
I don't know much about Sharpe ratios, but you showed with time, well, with the experience, that the Sharpe ratio increased for the traders. How do you control for changes in the market when you're doing this sort of study to know that it's not caused, that the change in the Sharpe ratio isn't caused by fluctuations in the market?
You mean the market increasing everyone's Sharpe ratio?
Yeah, for example, in a good season. Having some effect on it. Like, how generally were conducting these studies? Do you control the market fluctuations?
Well, there wasn't anything particular. I mean, I don't know. I have to think about that. I don't think that was. It's interesting, but I don't.
Yeah, I find it interesting also.
Yeah. Let me think that. Let me think about that.
Again, I did not get the question.
If the market is going to be higher and if they can make more money because the market is going to be higher, the Sharpe ratio could be higher too.
Okay, but then the so distribution will move.
Exactly. Yeah. The good people will do that much better.
But it's kind of taken into account because the standard deviation is higher during periods.
Yeah. Thank you.
Inex? Hope so.
Yeah.
Well, based on your findings, then, would you say if a trader could take a product or a steroid to increase their testosterone level, they would become a better trader then?
You know, when this paper, the first paper came out, I was asked by two journalists. During the credit crisis, two journalists said that they had heard the traders in the city were losing money and started taking Androgel for precisely that reason. No, because I think as one of the last slides, it said the important thing about these steroids is that they spike up and then they come back down to base. And if you're providing it from the outside, then you're just taking it up and it's going to stay up and you lose that homeostatic mechanism, which is as important as the spike. So it would be like someone who did that, it would be like building a sports car with the accelerator on full and no brake. Then you'd have a rogue trader. So I don't think that would happen. I think that what the athletes are doing is more interesting, which is looking for natural ways to get. I mean, it's really weird within Olympics. You think Olympic training regimes are like 90% strength and motion training. It's not. It's hormones. It's like how to get these hormones up naturally. It seems to be a one variable activity. You and then you afterward.
So yeah. Given your last concluding comment, if banks do that, their profit levels will go way down.
I don't think so.
If they hire people who don't trade as well as the ones with high testosterone, they won't do as well.
Well, I didn't say that. I said that these guys made more money at high frequency trading when they were on the upward sloping part of the inverted U-shaped dose response curve. But what we've just seen is that they easily go over the top and become rogue traders. And we've also found that their high variance style of trading is pretty short term.
You said you used it in your study over 20 months and none of them lost money. That's
right, but it also wasn't a bubble. I don't know if these guys would, but you see, these guys, I'm not sure the risk management on this floor was so draconian, and they were on profit sharing, that they had management and compensation structures in place that was leaning against these natural inclinations, whereas most of the banks have management structures and compensation schemes that feed them. So, for example, I think if you had, that you see, the trouble that women encounter in the financial world is that people get impatient with them and with older men because they want people trading in and out, making profits. And, you know, you haven't made money in a month. They put heat on you. But if women are more comfortable with asset management, in other words, you know, researching a trade for 3 weeks, putting it on and holding it for 2 years, that's not something the banks reward right now. If you change the compensation structure in the bank so that everyone got paid once in a business cycle, so that, you know, they didn't care what you made this year, they cared about your average P&L over a 5-year period, you'd probably find that the bank's selecting for more women. That's what I think. I don't think you need affirmative action. I think you need a change in the comp structure, and then the markets will select for more women and older men, I'm glad to say, as an aging man. So you had a question?
I actually wanted to address a couple of those issues with the men and the older men and women. First of all, in terms of the high-frequency trading, their skill sets are not going to be as good as the young men simply because their scanning abilities as they get older are not going to be as good, their reaction time and all of that. So that they would probably select themselves against even being in that particular field because of declining abilities in those areas. And the other thing, well, and then aside from that, I was wondering how many of these young men that are on the trading floor do video games in their spare time?
Very, very, very fantastic question. That's really interesting.
The scanning aspect of it.
I thought these guys might have been, I asked the managers, I said, are these guys into extreme sports? And they said, no. I think the most extreme thing they do is fly fishing. And then I later asked whether they were video game fanatics, and they said yes. So yeah, it's the right, I think, that's the question. I think the reason there are so many, why this is a predominantly male activity is the same reason why gaming is so overwhelmingly male. It's possible. That's something we'd like to look at. Yeah.
And then just last, coming from sports, my background is in sports psychology. So I would say that part of the issue with training really elite athletes is having them really learn to control their anxiety levels so that they're just on actually the downslope of the curve, let's see. So you learn to, like, when you really need to perform, to make sure your anxiety levels are just below where you need to be. And Elvis Stoico was a really good example of that. He used to be able to manage it quite well. And if you can't, then you really screw up in your performance. So one of the things that would be to teach people how to really monitor that, because the stress levels are going to cue them as to their anxiety levels. And just to dampen it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are all kinds of techniques you can use to do that.
Yeah. That's why I say I think the banks could learn from the sports psychologists. Yeah. In fact, the training manager on this trading floor was a sports psychologist. And some of the banks are now, I've been contacted by a couple of banks who are thinking of looking at physiological markers as well. Which makes it easier, because sometimes you can't tell whether you're stressed or not. I mean, one thing that's interesting, these guys, Hennessy and Levine, did this interesting experiment where they put a rodent in an open field. And rodents shouldn't be in an open field. They don't like to be there. And so if you put them in an open field, they show all the classic symptoms of animal symptoms of stress. They freeze, they defecate, Their cortisol levels go through the roof. They repeated it every day for 5 days, and by the fifth day, nothing bad had happened, and the fear behavior went away. They didn't freeze. They didn't defecate. They were basically saying, I'm cool with this. I can handle this. But their cortisol levels were still through the roof. And we found the same thing with the traders, that we gave them a questionnaire each day. You know, are you stressed? Granted, it wasn't a very good questionnaire. And there was absolutely no connection between their answers on the questionnaire and what you might think of as objective reality, like whether the markets were extremely volatile, whether they were losing money, whether they were at risk or whatever. But their bloody hormones got it right. And their hormones were responding. If the volatility was high, so were their hormones. So when that rodent is out there going, I'm cool with this, but its cortisol levels are through the roof, is that rodent stressed or not? And when the traders are saying, I'm cool, but their cortisol levels are through the roof and so is volatility, are they stressed or not? And it's sort of, I think issues like this are going to come up increasingly with neuroscience. Mm-hmm. You know, which matters, their opinion or their physiology? I tend to think their physiology does, because it seems to be correlated more with the sorts of things that can harm them. I mean, it's curious.
From a design perspective, if we stay in those high-frequency trading, you have the benefits of having the science on the background of having been a real trader for so many years. Are there any design mechanism that could it be designed any differently the way this part of finance service works that would be less challenging for human biology and still having the same some of the same outcomes?
You mean, can you remove the biology from the markets?
No. Can you design? I don't know. Can you think of different ways of operating this actually financial services that would, if you look at, it's about uncertainty, it's about speed, it's.
The biggest, most revolutionary change in finance in the past 10 years is the emergence of the black box. These economic numbers I told you about, like the unemployment number, I used to trade those. The number would come out, would say, you know, the unemployment rate in the U.S. has gone from 6 to 6.3%. We'd go, ooh, and start trading, you know, the bonds. But you can't do that anymore because the black box is now trade. A black box can process a trade in 10 milliseconds. A human will take about 80 milliseconds for a mouse click and maybe 300 milliseconds for a basic decision. So we're out of the game. And they trade before, by the time a human has read what the unemployment rate is, the trading is over. And there might be $1 trillion worth of bonds traded. So, I mean, a lot of people think that these things will remove biological influences from the markets. But
and remove the need for human traders.
Yeah. So far, these boxes are... they're trading much like the high-frequency traders. They're not calling the long-term trends. They're just looking at the noise.
Is data mining? What is it?
You know, what kind of algorithms are they using?
Yeah.
You know, there's a guy named Simons who runs Renaissance Capital at the end of Long Island. He's a very famous mathematician, and he just sucks up linguists, computer programmers, code breakers, mathematicians, physicists, and they disappear into Long Island to build these boxes, and no one has ever found out what they're doing, but the guy's got a sharp ratio of 40 and has had it for 20 years. And no one will ever talk because when people leave Renaissance, no one ever talks because he's had them sign a non-disclosure agreement that must be so scary, given that everyone in the world wants to know what that guy is doing and would pay for it, no one talks. So, you know, what goes into those black boxes is, I mean, I understood the first couple of boxes built, but since then I haven't got, it's left me in the dust. Yeah.
I think it's extremely interesting what you're talking about, but I think you missed one thing, which is kind of, if you want to understand the markets, it's a collective phenomenon. Yeah. I don't know how exactly you would do, but I think what you're doing is the way forward. I would just be very interested if you could somehow try to deduce what would be the collective response of traders.
We're trying to. I don't know whether we're going to get around to it, but there is such a thing as endocrine contagion, which so these hormonal surges could actually like roll through the population. They've done a couple of experiments where with sports fans during the World Cup, and their hormone levels of the fans mimic the teams, so that when Brazil won the World Cup and Italy lost, the Brazil's fans' T levels skyrocketed, and the Italian fans refused to participate any longer in the experiment. But the few that did give levels, they were down. So, yeah, these things seem to sort of roll through a population.
Talking about this, are there known cross-cultural differences in baseline, in the average baseline levels in testosterone and cortisone?
I've only seen two papers which compared people in Boston with a tribe in Africa and some villagers in South America. And as you might expect, the Americans had much higher T levels than the people living. Yeah.
A quote from John Manning, the guy who started
before
you. Yeah. He said that the difference between a man and a woman is sometimes smaller than the difference between people from two different countries in Europe.
Yeah.
Sometimes the ethnic difference in the organizational level is really high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the woman's side, it would be interesting to look at within gender variability in both testosterone and cortisol. There are variability, and see to what extent it relates to the patterns.
Yep. What about it? Yeah.
Just to recap, because I'm thinking about risk management, the implications, you know, as a practitioner, and I have no training, winning streaks, looking for them. You mentioned diversity also, but what about workplace design? You know, what does it mean? Do we change the way we design the training floor?
Well, I guess I was thinking more of the management thing, how you the relationship between middle management and the traders. That has to be thought through so that they stop bullying the people.
Mm-hmm. But if you think of trading design, you answer my question with the black box, but without getting to the black box in there, kind of sometimes it's minor design in various environment cues that impact biology. Think harder.
Think harder. You try. That's a first. Okay, I promise to think harder. Well, I didn't get into it enough, I think, but the way that the risk management and the compensation schemes, that can really lean against these things. And right now we're both management, you know, feeds these things. They don't lean against them. On this floor they lean against them. So that's the biggest area. I mean, risk management and the compensation schemes should be overhauled.
No, the reason why I was asking is that those hormones do react to physical cue in the environment, so that's why.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
That's what I was saying. Maybe just the way the information is presented, the place. I don't know. That's if you look at the, you talk about novelty, uncertainty, yeah, and the third one, and this translates into design features.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's interesting. At one point with this trading floor, Before the credit crisis hit, we were thinking of experimenting with seating arrangements. We thought that who was sitting beside who would probably have a big effect, but we never got around to it because the credit crisis came.
Is there any new data that you've collected or are collecting that you can speak to us a little bit about relating to testosterone?
We do have some. And I'm a blabbermouth. I love talking about stuff, but I've got four colleagues who are medics that are regularly telling me to put a sock in it, so I think I'll...
One question when you say that we need to move on the stock markets or the financial market as having prices as the key signal, which is also what we talk about when we talk about getting other signals so that you get business to do to make the cost of virtue being less costly, whether it's for health promoting products or whatever. How do you foresee that price becomes less the key market signal?
I didn't mean market signal. I meant policy tool.
Okay.
Because,
okay.
I mean, basic monetary policy is a price signal.
Okay.
And I don't think they're effective with people who've got chronically elevated levels of steroids. That's why I thought you had to start thinking of policies other than price signals, such as increasing the number of women in the market.
Okay. Any last question?
Did you have one? Oh, okay.
Thank you so much.